Have you ever walked into an old building and felt, well, something, a presence maybe, or perhaps heard an unexplained noise?
Yeah.
You know, that just sends a shiver down your spine.
Oh, definitely. It touches on something really deep within us, doesn't it?
It really does.
Yeah.
This persistent human fascination with the unseen. The possibility that there's more to existence than just, well, the physical world we see and touch every day.
Absolutely. And that curiosity, that desire maybe to connect or even just understand what happens after physical death, it feels like it's woven right into human history itself.
Like it goes way back.
Way back. Predates written records, maybe even predates many of the formal religions we think of today.
Exactly. And for centuries, millennia probably, people have looked for ways to, I don't know, bridge that gap between our world and whatever might come next.
Well, that search for connection, yeah. That exploration of the unseen.
That's precisely what we're diving into today. So welcome, everyone. This is our deep dive into the history of mediumship and the rise of a movement that really brought these ideas into the spotlight, spiritualism.
And we've got quite a stack of sources here for this one. Historical articles, research notes, even bits from official records like parliamentary debates. Really fascinating stuff.
So our mission today is to unpack all of this, pull out the key information, the, you know, surprising facts, the different viewpoints these sources offer on what's undeniably a complex topic.
Yeah, it really is. We're going to trace this whole idea from what some sources suggest are its most ancient roots.
Right.
Through some really pivotal figures to the, well, the dramatic birth of what we call modern spiritualism.
And how it spread so fast, the challenges it faced. I mean, everything from accusations of fraud right up to legal battles. That struggle for legitimacy.
It's a journey that cuts across history, belief systems, personal experiences, which can be incredibly profound for the people having them, and even into the, well, the drier details of law and organizations.
And we get that this touches on sensitive areas for a lot of people. Belief, loss, the unknown.
Definitely. So our aim here is really just to stick to presenting the information from these specific sources, clearly, impartially, and, you know, respectfully, helping you understand the historical story and the facts as they're laid out in this material we have.
Right. It's about understanding the narrative presented in the sources. It's quite a story, a real journey through time, belief, that very human desire to know what's out there. Let's get into it.
Okay, so let's go right back. Maybe even before recorded history, as you said, the sources we looked at suggest this idea, communication beyond the physical isn't just ancient. It might actually predate formal religion as we know it.
Wow. So think about earliest humans grappling with life, death, dreams, the world around them.
Exactly. And the sources hint at this possibility that maybe, just maybe, early peoples had glimpses, you might call them psychic experiences, or saw things, apparitions perhaps.
Not necessarily like in a ceremony, but just happening spontaneously.
Yeah, perhaps. Unexpected moments. And the theory presented is, well, based on these potential sightings, seeing images of people who weren't physically there, figures that maybe appeared and disappeared, they started to assign characteristics, maybe even human-like forms, to their gods or to the forces they felt governed the world.
Because how else would you explain it if you see something that looks human but doesn't follow the rules?
Right. And these apparitions, being outside normal experience, they could easily spark fear, awe, maybe eventually adoration, leading to them being seen as having divine power.
That makes a kind of intuitive sense.
Right.
And the sources also suggest that ancestor worship could be a really direct origin point for what later became spiritualism.
Yes, that's a strong thread. The idea starts simply, you know, at the family level.
Right.
Respect, maybe a form of worship for parents, grandparents who've passed.
Okay.
Then as societies got bigger, maybe tribes, this reverence expands. Ancestors of the chief become guides or protectors for everyone.
Ah, I see. From family to tribe.
And then maybe even further. In more complex societies, nations, this could evolve into venerating national heroes, founders.
Yeah.
Elevating them to a status like powerful spirits, still able to interact with the living.
So a continuous belief that personality, identity somehow persists and can still connect.
Exactly. It shows that consistent thread. And within this long history, the sources point to channeling as possibly the oldest form of spirit communication itself.
Channeling. Okay, how is that different from mediumship, according to these sources? They often get confused.
They do. The distinction made here is that channeling is typically described as receiving broader information, religious, spiritual, maybe prophetic stuff.
So bigger picture ideas.
Yeah, maybe from disincarnate entities or concepts like a higher self, spirit guides. Some accounts even mention extraterrestrials. It's often about wisdom, universal truths, guidance on a grander scale.
Whereas mediumship, which we'll get into more, tends to focus on connecting with specific people who've died, loved ones, friends.
Precisely. Relaying more personal messages, often proof of survival intended for someone specific who's still living. Related concepts, definitely, drawing on that same idea of spirit interaction, but different in scope and purpose, at least as the sources frame it.
Got it. Now, the sources also dive into biblical accounts, which is, well, it's fascinating, interpreting them through this specific lens of spirit communication.
It really is, and it offers a perspective that's sometimes quite challenging compared to, you know, traditional religious interpretations.
Definitely. Take the story of Samuel in the Old Testament. The sources describe him hearing a voice as a boy serving Eli in the temple.
Right. And Eli at first thinks Samuel's just calling him, but it happens again. And Eli realizes this is something else. Communication from the spirit realm.
And he tells Samuel how to respond.
Yes, crucially, Eli instructs him, "Speak, Lord, for thy servant heareth." And from the spiritualist viewpoint presented in these sources, this moment is seen as Samuel opening up, understanding his own innate mediumistic gift.
So the prophecy he then receives about Eli and his sons, that's seen as a message delivered by a spirit.
Exactly. And later, Samuel advises people, gets messages for them, which is presented as him practicing his developed mediumship.
Okay. Then there's that really famous, maybe more dramatic story, King Saul and the medium at Endor.
Ah, yes. Saul is portrayed here as a king in crisis, terrified of the Philistines, and importantly, having lost his own connection to spirit guidance.
Why did he lose it?
The source suggests it was because he didn't value it. He stopped listening to the guides available to him. Didn't appreciate that connection.
Interesting point about responsibility there. So even though he'd banished all the mediums.
Right. Hypocrisy, maybe?
Okay.
Or just desperation. He disguises himself and goes to find this woman at Endor.
And she's terrified when she realizes who it is.
Understandably. But Saul reassures her. And what happens next is presented as clear mediumship. The spirit Samuel appears to the medium. She describes him to Saul, confirming communication is happening.
And the message Samuel delivers isn't about winning the battle.
No, not at all. It's a stark reminder to Saul about his past actions, how he ignored right and wrong, and how that directly led to him losing touch with his spirit guides. It really ties spiritual connection to moral behavior in this interpretation.
Now, here's where the sources present something that, well, it directly challenges core beliefs for many people. Moses and the Ten Commandments.
Yes, this is a major point of reinterpretation. From the spiritualist perspective in these sources, the spirit Moses speaks with on Mount Sinai. They don't see that as the creator, as God Almighty.
Who do they see it as?
They identify this entity as a lower spirit guide named Jehovah, a guide who, in their view, still had his own issues, his own limitations, operating on a different level, perhaps, than the ultimate divine source.
Wow. And this view extends to the commandments themselves, the stone tablets.
It does. Instead of a direct miracle from the creator, they interpret the writing on the stone tablets through the lens of mediumistic phenomena, specifically slate writing or an apport.
Things that mediums claim to do later, like messages appearing on sealed slates.
Exactly. Or objects materializing seemingly out of nowhere. They see the commandments as a physical manifestation produced by this spirit guide, Jehovah, using these kinds of methods.
That is a really significant departure from traditional Jewish and Christian understanding.
It absolutely is. The sources themselves acknowledge the conflict. Traditional views see Moses having this unique, direct line to God. Fundamentalist views would completely reject any suggestion. It wasn't God communicating directly and creating the tablets. We're just laying out how these specific sources interpret the same story through their framework. It's fascinating how one text can lead to such different conclusions.
It really shows how a belief system can reframe foundational stories to fit its own core ideas.
Yeah.
And the sources do something similar with Jesus, right? Seeing mediumship throughout his life.
Very much so. Practicing spiritualists, according to these sources, often view Jesus as maybe the greatest medium ever. They see his arrival as being prepared for by the spirit world. Gabriel, for instance.
As the angel Gabriel.
Yes, but seen here as an advanced spirit messenger, playing a key role, like appearing to Zechariah to announce John the Baptist's birth.
And the sources highlight specific words.
They do. Gabriel saying John would speak in the spirit and power of Elias, Elijah. Uh-huh. This is interpreted as Elijah acting as a spirit guide, speaking through John. And Zechariah being struck mute is seen as a physical effect of such powerful spirit communication.
Okay. And Gabriel appearing to Mary and Joseph, too.
Same idea. Communications from the spirit realm guiding events on earth. But a really central event for this view is the Transfiguration.
Right, in the Gospels. Jesus on the mountain with Peter, James, and John.
And suddenly, Moses and Elijah appear. Long dead, obviously. And they're talking with Jesus.
How do the sources frame that?
As a clear, powerful demonstration of Jesus' incredible mediumship. The materialization of these long-departed figures, the conversation, it's presented as undeniable proof of spirit interaction at a very high level.
And beyond that specific event,
Jesus' whole life is interpreted through this lens. He's described in the sources as a gifted healer, a medium, someone who could see the future, prophesy, facilitate materializations, see and speak with spirits regularly. While Christianity focuses on his divinity and teachings, spiritualists, based on these sources, see his abilities and miracles as evidence of profound mediumship.
So, pulling back from the specifics, the big picture from these ancient examples is that belief in spirit communication is incredibly old, deeply rooted.
Yes, appearing in different forms across cultures, across time, even within the core texts of major religions, though interpreted differently, obviously. It's a persistent thread, this idea of connection beyond the veil.
Okay, so let's move forward in time a bit.
Yeah.
The sources point to some key figures who weren't maybe founders of spiritualism, but definitely acted as precursors. Their ideas, their experiences seem to resonate with what came later.
Absolutely. A really significant one is Emanuel Swedenborg, lived 1688 to 1772. An intriguing guy.
Because he started out very scientific.
Extremely. Highly respected Swedish scientist, astronomer, engineer, deeply rooted in the rational, observable world. Which makes his later experiences stand out even more.
What happened?
The sources say his major psychic and spiritual experiences kicked in around age 55.
His life shift.
Big time. He started having these incredibly vivid visions, and his descriptions of the afterlife, as reported in the sources, were remarkably detailed, not some vague ethereal place.
What was it like?
More like an earth life. Houses, churches, schools, even palaces. Though the sources do add a little note that scholars think his descriptions might have been, you know, influenced by his own upbringing and surroundings.
Fair enough. Did he have other ideas that connect?
Yes, particularly around healing. The sources link him to animal magnetism, that old idea of an invisible force. Swedenborg suggested this force connected everything and really emphasized the importance of sympathy, connection between healer and patient. He called it rapport.
Rapport, we still use that term.
Exactly. It shows a lasting influence, even if animal magnetism faded. His career path was unusual, too. Studied theology, philosophy, law, medicine, but didn't really practice medicine conventionally. Clearly a very broad, searching intellect.
Okay, and then there's Andrew Jackson Davis, the Poughkeepsie seer.
Right. He reportedly showed psychic signs very early on, but his path really took a turn after he went to lectures on mesmerism, hypnotism, basically in Poughkeepsie around 1843.
Mesmerism was big then, wasn't it?
It was. And the sources say a local tailor who was into mesmerism helped put Davis into a trance state.
And in that state,
he apparently showed amazing abilities, like diagnosing medical problems really accurately.
How did he say he did it?
He described it as seeing with his spirit eyes, so the human body became transparent to him. Organs had a sort of luminosity, a light that would dim or change color if there was disease. Psychic diagnosis, essentially.
Wow. But maybe his biggest contribution, timing-wise, was a prediction.
Yes, uncanny timing. In his 1847 book, The Principles of Nature, just a year before Hydesville, Davis basically predicted that spirits would soon start communing openly with people on Earth. He called it a living demonstration of spiritual communion.
That is really close to what happened next.
It is. And interestingly, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, Mr. Sherlock Holmes himself, noted how similar Swedenborg's and Davis's visions of the afterlife were.
Did Doyle think Davis just copied Swedenborg?
No. The sources say Doyle was careful not to suggest that. He actually praised Davis, called him very humble-minded, and of stuff that saints are made of. Seems Doyle found him genuinely convincing.
Interesting, given Doyle's later championing of spiritualism. So you have these figures, Swedenborg, Davis, exploring this territory. Not quite the organized movement yet, but definitely precursors.
Setting the stage, in a way.
And then comes the moment, the place, the date that most people point to. March 31st, 1848, Hydesville, New York. A little cottage. This is seen as the spark, right?
The commonly accepted start date for modern spiritualism, yes. And the story starts simply, almost like a classic ghost story, with weird noises.
Experienced by the Fox family.
Yes, particularly the daughters, Kate and Margareta. They kept hearing these rapping sounds in their house, unexplained knocks.
Just random noises at first?
Seemed so. But the key moment, the breakthrough according to the sources, was when they realized the raps seemed to respond. Like if they clapped, a rap might answer.
Ah, intelligent response. That changes everything.
Exactly. Suddenly it's not just noise, it's potential communication. So they started experimenting, figured out a simple code, raps for letters or yes-no answers.
Their first telephone line to the other side, sort of.
You could say that. And through this code, they started getting messages. The entity first called itself Mr. Splitfoot.
Which sounds a bit demonic.
Right. Must have been unsettling. But later, it apparently identified itself as Charles B. Rosna, claimed he was a peddler murdered in that house years before, body buried in the cellar.
Okay, that provides a specific story for the phenomena. And word got out.
Like wildfire. Neighbors came over to witness it. News spread through the community, then further afield.
And this wasn't the only place things started happening.
No, the sources say as the Fox sisters' story spread, other people started coming forward, saying they had similar psychic abilities or started experiencing similar things. It was like opening a floodgate. Margareta Fox gave the first public demonstration in New York City in 1849.
Only a year later.
Yeah.
Things moved fast. And the types of communication started evolving, too. It wasn't just rapping.
No, it diversified quickly. The sources list several distinct forms of mediumship that developed.
Like what?
Well, there was slate writing. Mediums claimed spirits could write messages on slates, sometimes even when the slates were sealed together. A Dr. Henry Slade was apparently famous for this.
Okay. What else?
Table tipping became very common. You know, groups sitting around a table and it would start moving, tilting, maybe even lifting off the floor, supposedly by spirit power.
Right. And trance.
Trance mediumship, yes. The medium goes into an altered state, and a spirit entity supposedly uses their voice, their body, to speak or deliver messages.
In the most dramatic form.
Probably physical mediumship. This involved claims of spirits actually materializing. Sometimes just parts, like hands. Sometimes maybe full figures. Often associated with this substance called ectoplasm.
Ectoplasm. What was that supposed to be?
The sources describe it as this sort of organic compound believed by spiritualists to come from the medium's own body, their cells, which spirits could then use as, like, raw material to make themselves physically present or move objects.
Interesting.
Daniel Douglas Home is mentioned as a really famous physical medium, known for all sorts of things, levitations, handling hot coals, materializations.
It's easy to see how all this would capture public attention, especially, as the sources note, around the time of the U.S. Civil War. So much loss, so much grief. People were searching for answers, for connection.
Exactly. The timing was potent. Within about a decade of Hydesville, you really had a significant spiritualist movement developing.
And it wasn't just happening in isolation. The sources make a really interesting point about the context. The timing lines up almost perfectly with two other big developments.
Right. The invention and spread of the telegraph and the huge growth of the show business and entertainment industry.
The telegraph connection is fascinating. How did that play in?
It provided a perfect modern metaphor. Early spiritualists literally used telegraphy terms. They saw the spirits' coded knocks, like the Hydesville raps, as being like telegraph taps.
Mm-hmm.
Messages coming down a different kind of wire from an unseen source.
That's brilliant. It makes it relatable, technologically current for the time.
Absolutely. And it wasn't just a metaphor. The spread of the movement, the sources argue, was massively boosted by the media landscape.
Nice.
Newspapers, magazines. They were exploding in reach.
And they covered spiritualism.
Extensively. Reports on seances, profiles of mediums, debates about whether it was real. This meant the ideas reached a huge audience incredibly quickly, much faster than maybe traditional religious or scientific ideas might have traveled back then.
And spiritualism itself jumped right into this new landscape. It wasn't just quiet circles in homes.
Oh, no. The sources say mediums embraced the entertainment industry wholeheartedly.
How so?
Performing in theaters, to big crowds, paying audiences. They had managers, agents, went on tours, advertised. They basically became celebrities in their own right.
So the public demonstrations were designed to be impressive.
Very much so. The sources use words like spectacularism and theatricality. They needed to capture attention, entertain, convince.
Though the home seance was still important too.
Yes, that remained a core part, more intimate, personal. But the visibility, the rapid spread, owed a lot to these public performances and the whole entertainment infrastructure.
But this link to showmanship, it must have created problems too, like with spirit photography.
Exactly. That's a great example the sources bring up. People trying to get photos with spirits of loved ones.
And they got these images.
Yeah.
Ghostly figures, orbs.
Yeah, often translucent faces or shapes hovering near the sitter, presented as absolute proof.
But photography was new then. Technically tricky.
Very. And the sources explain how easily effects could be created, accidentally or deliberately. Light leaks in the camera, getting a double exposure on the photographic plate, or just outright manipulation by someone wanting to cash in.
Things we'd probably spot easily today with our understanding of Photoshop and digital images.
Right. We're much more sophisticated, or maybe just cynical now. But back then, without that technical knowledge, these photos could seem incredibly real, powerful visual evidence.
Which brings us right to the heart of a major challenge for the movement: fraud. The sources are pretty clear about this, aren't they?
Yes, they state plainly that while many people were sincere believers, there were definitely unscrupulous individuals who saw mediumship as a way to make money, to exploit grief. And this fakery cast, as one source puts it, a dark light on the whole movement.
Especially early on, with maybe not much regulation.
Exactly. It was hard for the public, even for believers, to know who was genuine and who was just putting on a show.
So did the movement try to clean house?
It did. The sources mention organizations forming within spiritualism specifically to combat fraud. They tried to set standards, offer testing, accreditation for mediums, often through their own schools or lyceums.
It attempted self-policing.
Yeah.
But they also faced scrutiny from outside, right? From science.
Oh, absolutely. As it got more popular, scientists started paying attention. Some were genuinely curious, wanted to investigate the claims. Others were deeply skeptical from the start.
And Sir Arthur Conan Doyle pops up again here, challenging the skeptics.
He does. He was so convinced, he apparently challenged Scientific American magazine, a major publication, to conduct a proper, serious investigation into psychic phenomena.
And they did?
They took up the challenge, launched a public contest offering a big prize, $5,000, which was a lot of money then for anyone who could produce conclusive psychic phenomena under strict test conditions.
Designed to rule out cheating. Who judged it?
A really interesting panel. Scientists, sure, but also people known as professional ghost chasers, and crucially, the great magician, Harry Houdini.
Houdini, the escape artist. He was famous for debunking mediums, wasn't he?
Yes. He had a deep understanding of illusion and deception and made it a bit of a crusade to expose fraudulent spiritualists.
So who took the challenge? Anyone prominent?
The most famous case was a medium named Mina Crandon, who went by Marjorie. The sources describe the results of her tests as conflicted. Messy, really.
How so?
Well, initially, most of the judges were undecided. Only one actually voted for her. They just weren't sure if they'd seen real phenomena or just very clever tricks they couldn't figure out.
But then something happened.
Yeah. Apparently, a rumor leaked to the press that the magazine was actually going to rule in Marjorie's favor, say she was authentic.
And Houdini reacted.
Strongly. He cast the deciding vote against her and went public, denouncing her as a fraud.
Did he prove how she did her tricks?
That's the interesting part. The sources note that even Houdini couldn't definitively explain how she produced all the phenomena observed under the controlled conditions. But he used his fame, his media access, to really discredit her.
Yet she remained popular.
Within spiritualist circles, yes. And she continued to be studied, even at Harvard. It just shows how deep the divisions were, how hard it was to get conclusive proof either way that satisfied everyone back then.
So alongside the scientific debates and the fraud issue, there were legal battles too, especially in the UK.
Yes, the Hanser excerpts in our sources give a fascinating glimpse into this. Spiritualism had to fight for basic legal recognition to stop mediums being prosecuted under some really old, quite frankly, bizarre laws.
Like what?
Primarily the Witchcraft Act of 1735. Imagine. In the mid-20th century.
Using a witchcraft law against mediums.
And the Vagrancy Act of 1824 as well. The core problem with the Witchcraft Act, as discussed in a 1951 parliamentary debate shown in the sources, was the wording. It criminalized pretending to use occult powers.
Pretending? That sounds tricky.
Very, because as MPs argued, it could be interpreted to mean that simply claiming you had mediumistic abilities was illegal, even if you genuinely believed it. It didn't necessarily require proof of intent to deceive someone, just the act of pretending to have the power.
So your sincere belief could land you in court.
That was the fear. It risked treating a religious practice, however unconventional, as a criminal act of pretense.
So the debate in Parliament was about changing this.
Exactly. It was framed very much as extending religious toleration to spiritualists. MPs were pushing to repeal or amend these old laws, specifically where they were being applied to spiritualist mediums.
To protect the honest ones.
That was the term used, yes. Protecting honest mediums, people they saw as sincere practitioners of their faith, from being lumped in with rogues and vagabonds under the Vagrancy Act, or unfairly targeted by the Witchcraft Act just because someone didn't believe them.
It really highlights a legal bind, doesn't it? Proving actual fraud, deliberate deception for gain is hard.
It is, especially if the investigator starts from a position of total disbelief. Everything looks like a trick, but proving how it was done or proving the medium knew it was fake, that's tough.
So the Witchcraft Act was almost a shortcut for prosecutors, focusing on the pretending part.
That seems to be the argument made in the debate. It allowed them to sidestep the need to prove fraudulent intent. The push was to get the law focused back on preventing actual fraud, not punishing the claim or the belief itself.
Was there a specific case mentioned?
Yes. The Duncan case was brought up. It seems to have been a prominent instance where the Witchcraft Act was used against a medium, really bringing this whole pretend versus claim issue into focus and highlighting the perceived unfairness.
So the arguments for changing the law were based on?
Fundamental principles, really. Toleration as a mark of civilization. The idea that English law shouldn't criminalize sincerely held religious beliefs, especially when held by thousands of people. Extending the liberty of the subject, as they put it.
Bringing the law into the modern age, essentially.
And even catching up with Scotland, apparently, where the Witchcraft Act hadn't been used like this for a long time.
Did this debate get sidetracked at all? Parliamentary debates sometimes do?
Huh. Well, the sources mention a brief, slightly amusing exchange where Sherlock Holmes gets brought up. An MP apparently called him an exponent of crafty science, maybe suggesting how skeptics could cleverly explain things away.
A touch of humor amidst the serious legal arguments.
It shows the real-world nature of these debates, but the core issue was serious. People fighting for the right to practice their beliefs without facing jail time under laws from centuries past. A fascinating intersection of law, belief, and history.
So despite all these hurdles, the fraud problem needing internal solutions, the intense skepticism from science, Houdini's campaign, the legal fights, spiritualism didn't just fade away.
Not at all. It endured, it adapted, and it really solidified itself. The sources make it clear it became established not just as a movement, but as a formal, recognized religion.
With actual churches, organizations?
Yes. Churches, centers, groups all over the world, UK, US, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, many others. There's even the International Spiritualist Federation acting as an umbrella group.
And a key part of becoming a formal religion is having defined beliefs, right? The sources mention the seven principles.
Exactly. Those are fundamental, particularly central to organizations like the Spiritualist National Union, the SNU in the UK. They form the core philosophy.
Let's quickly go through them as the sources lay them out. Number one, the fatherhood of God. What does that mean in this context?
It's presented as the idea of a universal life source, a creative force behind everything. Not necessarily a personal man in the sky god, but a fundamental underlying energy or intelligence.
Okay. Then the brotherhood of man.
This flows from the first one. If everything comes from the same source, then humanity is one big family. It emphasizes mutual support, compassion, giving and receiving help within that family.
Makes sense. Third, and this seems crucial, the communion of spirits. The mystery of angels.
Absolutely core. This is the belief that spirit communication is real, possible, and is the main proof of life after death. It also includes the idea that loved ones who've passed want to help or minister to those still on earth, usually through a medium.
Which connects to the fourth principle, the continuous existence of the human soul.
Right. This uses the idea that energy can't be destroyed, only change form. The soul, or spirit, is seen as that indestructible energy. When the body dies, the spirit continues in the spirit world, keeping its personality, memories, character, and it can keep developing.
Personality continuity is key there. Fifth is personal responsibility.
Pretty much the golden rule as you would be done by. taking ownership of your actions, your thoughts, your conduct, because they have consequences.
And Principle 6 explains those consequences. Compensation and retribution hereafter for all the good and evil deeds done on earth. Sounds a bit like judgment.
It's presented less as divine punishment and more as a natural law. Cause and effect. Be done by as you did. Your actions on earth create spiritual conditions or experiences for you in the afterlife. Spiritual accountability built into the system.
Got it. And the last one, number 7, eternal progress open to every human soul.
This offers hope, really. It suggests everyone has an inherent ability, a drive to progress spiritually, but it's not automatic. It depends on your desire, your effort. It takes work, learning, sacrifice, leading to higher understanding in the spirit world.
So these 7 principles, they provide a clear philosophical framework. You see them in spiritualist churches.
Yes, prominently displayed usually. They define the faith.
And the sources also show how organized the movement became, using the SNU rules as an example. This isn't just loose belief, it's structured.
Highly structured. Churches affiliate with the union, follow its rules. They can register legally as places of worship, which allows them to perform marriages, same as other religions.
And they deal with things like charity status, finances.
Yes. Seeking charitable status is often required if their income is high enough. That means financial transparency, audits, rules about spending, record keeping, very formalized.
What about joining? Are there rules for members?
Definitely. You have to accept the 7 principles, often after taking a course. They specify you shouldn't belong to an incompatible religious body. And significantly, background checks, criminal records, sex offender registries are required for members, especially leaders.
That sounds like a direct response to historical issues, ensuring safety and credibility.
It seems very likely. The rules cover committee structures, appeal processes for discipline, even legal indemnification for committee members doing their duties. It's quite comprehensive.
Do the rules even cover the mediumship practices themselves?
They do. For instance, physical mediumship might require invited members only, suggesting control. Transmediumship is acknowledged, but with a note that it's not recognized in law, meaning the medium is legally responsible for what they say, not some spirit entity.
Interesting legal distinction. What about healing?
Healing mediumship is part of spiritualist practice, but it needs to follow the SNU code of conduct to be covered by their insurance. Again, rules, procedures, accountability.
It really paints a picture of formalization. Moving from maybe chaotic beginnings and widespread phenomena to a structured religion, tackling issues like fraud head-on, seeking legal standing, defining beliefs.
It's a remarkable evolution, absolutely, showing how that deep human impulse we started with became codified, organized, and established itself as a distinct religious body that still exists today.
We've covered a huge amount of ground in this deep dive, haven't we?
We really have. From those possible ancient roots, glimpses of spirits, ancestor worship, the spiritualist interpretations of figures like Samuel and Jesus.
Right, through the precursors like Swedenborg and Davis, whose ideas sort of set the table.
To that pivotal moment in Hydesville with the Fox sisters, the spark that lit the fire of modern spiritualism.
And then its incredibly rapid spread, helped along by telegraph metaphors and the booming media and entertainment world.
Which led to all those different phenomena, table tipping, slate writing, trance, ectoplasm.
Yeah.
It also brought huge challenges.
Yeah, the constant battle with fraud, the intense scrutiny from science, people like Houdini, and those fascinating legal fights in the UK against ancient laws.
And finally, seeing how the movement responded by organizing, creating the 7 principles, the detailed structures, the rules, formalizing itself into the religion we see evidence of today.
So thinking about all this, for you, the listener, what's the takeaway? What does this history offer?
Well, I think it's a real window into just how diverse human belief can be. And into that powerful, enduring quest to understand consciousness, death, connection.
It also really shows how things like technology, media, the legal system, how they shape the way new ideas spread and are accepted or rejected by society, especially ideas that challenge the mainstream.
Yeah, you can't understand these movements without understanding their historical context.
So it makes you think, doesn't it? Given the centuries-long, maybe millennia-long human attempt to grapple with consciousness, connection, what lies beyond, and given the big questions science and philosophy still ask about reality and the mind.
How does exploring this specific history, the rise and formalization of spiritualism as laid out in these sources, how does that influence your own thoughts? About belief, about what counts as evidence, about those deep, persistent mysteries of human experience that drove this whole story.
Something to definitely keep pondering.